Hello and welcome to Untangled Resolution's presentation of The Problem is the Answer. I am your host, Batabi Limtombeni, and I'm coming to you live from Harlem, USA. Wall Street is occupied and the real financial crisis is still coming. What does that mean for you and your nest egg and your future? I am joined today by Sean Hyde, who has offered one of the plainest, most cogent explanations of what is happening and what you can do about it that I have heard to date. What I learned preparing for this show blew my mind, and I'm sure you will hear things that will give you pause as well. Listen in for Sean's advice about what you can do to survive the crisis to come. You are listening to one of my favorite musicians, Grammy-nominated jazz pianist Vijay Iyer. This piece is called Galang Trio Riot Version from his album Historicity. Sit back and listen while everyone gathers. We'll be back with you in just a moment. Everyone, I'm so very glad you've chosen to join us today. Today, I feel like Noah, Jonah, and the five virgins with oil in their lamps all rolled into one, if I may use biblical references. Go to Google the stories if you don't know what I'm talking about. I'm hoping not to be Chicken Little and the boy who cried wolf, on the other hand, but the upshot is, if you thought things were bad financially, there are some astute and seasoned financial experts who say we've only seen the tip of the iceberg. What is an ordinary person to do? My guest today is Sean Hyde, and I've invited him on the show to help us all to understand what is happening, why it is happening, and what we can do about it. Sean, your microphone is live. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
I'm so glad that you're here, and frankly, I hardly know where to begin. So I thought let's start with a story that caused us to become acquainted with each other last week. We just met last week over Facebook, so this is a virtual meeting, which is really interesting in and of itself, but last week, a stock trader named Alessio Rastani made a statement during an interview on the BBC that stunned everyone in the room and certainly stunned me and many other people who have since seen the interview. And the upshot of his statements were that the stock market is kaput. The real crash is still coming and that Goldman Sachs rules the world. I'm curious about your take on what Mr. Rastani had to say.
Well, I think, you know, he makes some valid points, and I think that there's a lot of truth in what he says. The stock market kaput, I mean, that's from a trader's perspective. So do I think we're going to see another steep decline? Yes. We had a really strong run-up. The stock market climbed faster than it's ever climbed before. We saw a strong pullback about halfway back to, you know, in the 7,000s, and I think we'll probably see that again. As far as it being done, it's never going to go away. You know, it's been here, you know, as long as people have offered shares in their business. And trading's been around for centuries, so that's not going anywhere. But I think people do have to be aware that if you're not taking some basic control and some basic awareness of your investments and your retirement and even your savings accounts to some extent, that you could see some problems from that. So I think it's just something that people need to be aware of, and it's kind of good that he's shocking people into a situation where they want to know more.
Well, right. You know, one of the things that he said that really stunned me was that he expects, I think, something like hundreds of thousands of people's savings to disappear. and in a way that hasn't happened up to this point. And that actually galvanized me to action. I was frustrated because he was making some suggestions. He said, you know, to move your investments into treasury bonds and things of that nature. And I'm thinking to myself, I don't even know what phone number to call to speak to somebody in order to get that to happen. And that's when I made the comment on Facebook that I did, and you responded, and that's what prompted me to ask you to come on the show. But I first want to get your perspective on why what he said might be relevant and important to the ordinary person.
Well, the ordinary person has to be aware that a lot of people are putting money into their 401k because their employer tells them to and because they're getting a match. And they don't even know what a 401k is, or they're not even aware of where their money is actually being invested in the 401k. And most people's 401ks are invested in mutual funds, and mutual funds are organizations that buy several different kinds of stocks and bundles. So when the market goes up, they tend to go up, but the market goes down, they tend to go down, and sometimes even faster. One of the problems with a mutual fund is they're so large, they can't move quickly. So even if we see the stock market tanking, it's not like you can turn around and sell 500 million shares or something in a day. That's a month or a two-month process. Well, anyone that's been watching the market has seen that it's dropping 5 and 6 and 7% in a day sometimes. So 2 months later, the money can literally be gone. So if you're not aware of what you're in and you're not able to move quickly, and address that and at least have a basic understanding, which is what I think the best thing that came out of his interview was. You know, a lot of people, when he talked about hedging and when, like you're saying, he talked about T-bills, a lot of people have no idea how to even do that. They don't know how to buy gold or silver. So, you know, if him coming out and saying that's what they should do is getting interest in learning that, then that's great. And it's really not difficult. I think that's the best thing that maybe people can learn. These days, you know, with the internet and trading accounts and online transactions, you have the ability to buy and sell almost anything with relative ease and safety.
Right. Well, let's start with something really basic and then get into some of the things that people can teach themselves. The question that came to me, you said, you know, that mutual funds are large and you know, can not move very quickly, and that when you see deep plunges in the stock market, they can happen basically overnight. You know, by the time they can move a few months later, it's too late and the money is gone. And the question that came to my mind is, where does the money go?
Well, the thing is with the stock market is a value is put on a company. So the money doesn't necessarily have to go anywhere. The stock market is one of the only true wealth creation machines we know. Like, for example, a lot of people have also heard of futures. If you trade futures, that's an actual contract. And if I make money, it's because I took it from somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
In the stock market, I can buy a share of a company for $20. I can sell it to you for $22. You can sell it to someone else for $24. They can sell it to someone else for $26, and so on. And as long as that stock keeps going up, we're all making money.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the few vehicles, if you want to call it that, where that's actually possible. So it's not a zero-sum game. It can actually create wealth. But at the same time, it's all in the value you put in the company. So if people don't value that company at that time, then the money, as you said, would quote-unquote disappear.
But let's talk about how the value of the stock is tied to the value of the company. How does that work? I guess maybe the really basic question is, you know, for some people out there, they really haven't thought about what is a stock and, you know, why is it that people are trading stocks, and how is it that the value of the stock is related to the value of the company?
Okay, well, a stock at its most basic level is a small portion of a company. What happens is someone will start a business and they'll start to grow, and they'll realize that they could grow exponentially if they have a lot more money. So they'll issue a certain number of stock shares that they'll sell to other people at a certain value, and then take the money from selling those shares and use it to expand the business. And that's where a stock comes from. So an actual stock is a very small portion of a company. So the stock price is basically the total value of that company divided by the number of shares available, and that's where each individual share goes. The actual value of the overall company is like anything else. It's perception, and it's what people are willing to pay for it. So that can change at any time. I mean, companies have been bought, the whole company, all the shares outstanding, for less than just the value of the buildings that the company owns at some points. And then we've also seen, you know, with the dot-com bubble back a decade ago, where companies that were losing, you know, $1 million a month and had no actual income were selling for hundreds of dollars a share. you know, because people put so much hope in what they might do in the future. So it's really perception. It's really the, you know, the current market interest mixed with the actual value of the company.
Okay. So ultimately, the value of the stock doesn't have to be directly tied to the value of the company.
No, it doesn't at all. It, like I said, it's really perception. And people really need to understand that, you know, your brokers, even your fund managers, they're salespeople to a major extent. If you're dealing with a stockbroker, he makes his money off of transactions, which means the only way he makes money is if you buy and sell, not if you make money when you buy and sell, just if you keep buying and selling. So it's in their best interest to get people to just buy and sell things all the time, whether it makes sense or not. So it's in their best interest to sometimes convince people that things are worth more or less than they actually are just to make that transaction happen.
Okay.
And, you know, brokers have become less prevalent now because a lot of things have become automated and electronic on the Internet, but they still have influence, and the news still has influence, and the guy at the gym that you overhear on a cell phone still has influence, unfortunately. And all those things can affect the stock price.
Right. So let's get really practical about that then. What will cause the price of a stock to rise or to fall?
It's basically like anything else. It's basic supply and demand. It's if people want it. You know, there's a limited number of shares out there. So it's like anything else. It's like, say, a Ferrari. You know, if they only make 500 a year, that's part of why they become so expensive. It's not just that they're a good car. It's that people want them, and there's not enough for everybody that wants them. Sometimes stock shares are the same way. You know, people might agree that the company is in good shape and that it's going to keep going forward, but, you know, if you really want a piece of that company, you're going to be willing to pay more than maybe it's worth. And just the fact that you paid more than it's worth makes someone else go, wow, maybe I need to pay more than it's worth, or I'm missing out, and so on and so forth.
Okay, and then the same thing can happen on the back end when the shares drop and the prices of a stock drop.
And that's actually even more common. There's actually an old expression. They say, you know, the bull runs up the stairs and the bear jumps out the window, referring to bull and bear markets. So bull markets typically go quickly but still staggered. And when the bear market hits, it's when you see, you know, your 5, 6, 10% drops in a day because people panic when they're selling. You know, a lot of people will say, wow, I know this stock is doing really well, I should buy it, and not ever buy it. But when people are watching their life savings drop at 5 and 10% a day, they typically will sell very quickly.
Right.
You know,
right.
And then that selling causes the next person to sell, because as everyone's selling, the stock price keeps dropping because people are willing to pay less and less for that stock. Because if you're going to sell a stock, you have to find a buyer.
Yeah, so you have to find somebody willing to buy. And then if nobody wants to buy the stock?
You keep going until you find someone willing to buy it, and that's the point. You know, if it's a stock that's out of favor, you know, it might have been $100 a share yesterday, but you might not find someone willing to buy it until you go down to $50 a share, and that's why you see sometimes stocks get cut in half overnight, because, you know, the risk-reward isn't there. It takes you that much of a drop to find someone that says, okay, I'll buy it at that price, because I think at that price it'll start to go up again.
Okay, wow. But here's then another question, and it may be review for some people who are listening, but I think that it helps for all of us to be on the same page to get this information before going forward with the conversation. Talk to me about the current volatility in the market. Where is that coming from?
Basically, volatility is generally considered a measure of fear. And basically what they have is they have the VIX is what it's referred to in short when you're dealing with the market, and that's a volatility index. I think it closed on Friday around 33 or 34, which I believe is more than double what it was 4 months ago.
Oh, my.
What happens with that is fear typically, as we talked about earlier, makes people sell more quickly. You know, people, it's the old people do more to avoid pain than they will to chase pleasure. So, you know, the minute they think they're losing their life savings, they're willing to do anything to get out of it and just have that pain go away of watching their account drop and drop and drop. And that's where that fear measurement comes in. Now, what that does is it also creates more expensive options, and it creates bigger bid and ask spreads. So it almost forces the market to have bigger swings.
Mm-hmm.
They can actually, to some extent, predict what kind of swings you'll see in the market just based on the VIX. I believe they came out last week and said, you know, the VIX at the 30, the low 30 rating we're at now would create an average of a 4% swing per day, and that's what we've been seeing
mm-hmm.
for the last week. Is pretty much every day there's about a 400% swing in the market, which equates to roughly that 4%. So
okay.
That's basically what you look at, is people act less rationally when they're fearful, so they're
right.
quicker to get in, they're quicker to get out, and they're, you know, they're willing to pay more when they think they're missing out, and they're willing to lose more when they're afraid they're not getting out fast enough.
Right. I think that we have an idea of where the fear is coming from. We're hearing every day about, you know, banks failing, about countries being in debt. We had our own debt ceiling crisis go on a few months ago and so forth, and that certainly has contributed to the fears of everybody, you know, people who are not familiar with the stock market, as well as those certainly who are an integral part of running the stock market. Talk to me a bit about what's going on with that and how that has contributed to the VIX index.
Well, I think one big thing people aren't making a connection on too is, yes, we have some serious default concerns all around the world. You know, it's not just Greece and Italy. It's a good chunk of Europe. It's us, quite frankly. You know, right now we can print all of our own money, but, you know, if we're not the world reserve currency anymore, the U.S. dollar, that could change too, and we could be at risk of default. You know, a lot of things could happen that could change that. On top of that, though, the transition of 401ks, you know, anyone that has talked to their parents or, you know, anyone from a generation before this one or the one before that had pensions, and
mm-hmm.
your pensions were insured and they were guaranteed and the company paid for it. And the transition of 401ks created a baby boomer generation and beyond that has all of their retirement tied up in stocks and mutual funds. Well, even if there's not a problem in the world, how are they going to get their money? They have to sell their stocks and mutual funds. So everyone that's coming into retirement that has 401ks right now, they're selling anyway just to get their money out. And if they're planning on retiring in the next few years and they're watching this market and they're unsure, well, they're going to sell now because they want that cash in hand and they don't want to have to worry about 5 years from now if they're going to have enough money to start their retirement. So I think there's a lot of different elements playing into this right now, and you're kind of getting a perfect storm where not only is there turmoil and fear economically in the world, but we actually created a situation where we had to have selling in the stock market that was going to increase coming into this time in the next 5, 10, 15 years.
Whoa. Now, that is something that I hadn't considered. You know, we spoke last week preparing for the show, and we talked about a number of things. That isn't one of them. So I'm sitting here thinking, oh, my goodness.
Well,
yes, not only are you having issues with, you know, the banks and the debt crisis and so forth, but we do have a very large population of people who are entering retirement age all at once right now.
And their retirement's tied into stocks and mutual funds and everything else. It's not their company pension plan anymore. You know, they're now responsible for when they sell their investments to take the money out. So when you add in the fact that, hey, a lot of them are retiring now, you know, like my parents are hitting retirement age, so their 401ks and their stock options from their companies that replace their pensions, well, the way they get their money to retire is by selling them. So
right.
you have increased selling pressure just naturally from that phenomenon, forgetting everything else that's going on, you know. So it could be a really big problem, even if the world is okay.
Right, right. But the world isn't okay.
Exactly. The world is a mess financially. You know, we're speaking, you know, pretty much in financial terms, and, you know, we're watching all these countries that their banks are failing and they're in risk of default, and, you know, no one knows where to go, and nobody's currency or money is backed by anything anymore. So the whole world has all this paper money that's basically an idea, you know, where it used to be backed by gold or silver or something else. Now it's just in a market where the same thing as a stock. Anyone at any time can say, I don't think your money's worth all that much,
okay.
you know. And we have these FX and these currency markets where every day, you know, the euro versus the dollar versus the Aussie dollar versus the yen fluctuates as much as any stock market does. And your money can become more or less valuable, you know, on a world purchasing power basis, you know, by tremendous swings at any given time.
Well, then why doesn't everybody just forgive everybody's debt and start from zero?
Well, I mean, I think, A, you can't really do that. A, the debt, I know we hear that China owns, you know, most of our debt, but they're A, they're not the only country, and B, individuals own the U.S. debt. I mean, your savings bonds, your U.S. savings bonds, most kids grew up with at some point, that's debt to the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
Your treasury bonds and your treasury bills you're talking about, that's debt from the U.S. Treasury. You know, so anyone that owns those is expecting money from the U.S. Treasury. Now, that's where your risk of default comes in. You know, like that trader saying T-bills are safe, but they may not be, because if we come to a point where the world says we're not going to use the U.S. dollar as a world reserve currency anymore, well, the U.S. can't really just print money to pay its debts anymore, and it might start defaulting. Well, it's also going to default on those, because those are just debts like every other debt they have. And quite frankly, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry to have cut you off. I wanted to back up just a moment and make sure, because I'm finding myself a little bit confused asking what's that, and that, you know, alerts me to say, ask a question about it.
Sure.
When you say that the U.S. dollar is the world reserve currency, what does that mean? What are the implications of that?
It basically means that as of right now, most international debts can be paid in the dollar or have to be paid in the dollar, that most international commodities are priced in the dollar. Like right now, oil is priced in U.S. dollars.
Mm-hmm.
Gold is priced in U.S. dollars. It's part of the reason why, even though people consider our gas prices very high right now, they're still essentially the cheapest in the world. You know, most countries comparable to us, your European, even some of the South Americans that aren't far, are paying $6 a gallon, $8 a gallon, $10 a gallon.
Wow.
And part of the reason we can keep our prices lower is because it's priced on our currency. So
mm-hmm.
we have the ability to adjust that a little bit. When that goes away, we can't just print money to pay debts anymore, because people don't have to accept the U.S. dollar to pay debts.
Okay.
So, you know, the situation we're in now is everyone saying, well, you know, we'll never default, we'll never have a government shutdown. You know, there's no concern about that because we can just keep printing money, which is true right now, but there may come a day where that's not true. There may come a day where we can keep printing money, but people don't have to take it anymore.
Wow. That is deep and that is serious. And actually, interestingly enough, we've come along far enough in the show that it's time for a quick break. So that's a moment where we can leave folks to ponder the implications of that, and when we come back, we will talk about what folks can do to try to mitigate as much as possible against the potential of this sort of thing happening, you know, the dollar being devalued, no longer being the world, the financial currency of the world. You know, what can people do? So we're going to take a quick break. Thank you so much, Sean. We'll be back in just a moment. I am going to play for you a piece that is called Darn That Dream by Vijay Iyer. Well, Vijay Iyer is performing it on his album Solo, which is available on iTunes. The piece is by Jimmy Van Heusen and Eddie DeLang. Darn That Dream. We'll be back in just a moment. Thank you. Welcome back to the show, everyone. I'm so glad that you've decided to join us, and I'm sure that you'll be glad you decided to join us as well. We're talking about the stock market, your 401k, and your financial future, what you can do to protect yourself in these really volatile times. And I'm glad to have my guest here today, Sean Hyde, who will be joining us again in just a few moments. I have an announcement for you. If you've ever wondered how those savvy negotiators get the best deals, you are in for a real treat, a real opportunity. If the thought of negotiating, be it with your sister or your boss or the president of your club, leaves you with a headache and makes you want to cry, never fear. If you are in the New York City area, you can overcome that fear and apprehension by perfecting your negotiation skills with me, live and in person. I am teaching negotiation at the fabulous New Work City. New Work City is located at 412 Broadway near Canal Street here in Manhattan. That's Manhattan. Classes begin on October 11th and continue on October 25th, November 1st, and end with a live simulation on November 8th. In the simulation, participants are placed into two teams. Each team's members will put the skills they've learned in the prior three classes to work by negotiating a contract. Don't you want to be a confident and successful negotiator? Join me from 7 to 9 p.m. on October 11th, 25th, November 1st, and November 8th at New York City, 412 Broadway near Canal Street. To sign up, go to Winning Negotiation, that's one word, winningnegotiation.eventbrite.com. That's winningnegotiation.eventbrite.com. And learn how to negotiate any situation with skill and confidence. You can also contact me by email at info@123untangled.com. That's info@123untangled.com. Or call me, 917-371-6560. That's 917-371-6560. And you can get all four sessions for just $120. That's right. All four sessions are just $120. So visit the Eventbrite website at winningnegotiation, one word, .eventbrite.com, or send email to info@123untangled.com, or call me at 917-371-6560. Feel free to leave a message and I'll get right back to you. I also want to say a few words about the movement to occupy Wall Street. I visited Zuccotti Park last week, and I was simply astounded by what I experienced. We the people are being represented there by one of the most organized, intelligent, determined, resilient, and awe-inspiring group of people I have ever met. What I saw inspired me to declare that this is the democracy we learned about in school. One of the posters I saw said, "Democracy ain't cheap. You've got to earn it, and earning it they are." In fact, it has just started raining outside our window right now, and I know those folks in Zuccotti Park are being rained on, and they've been rained on for the last 3 or 4 days now, actually, but they are hanging in there, and they're staying put. They are there for each and every person who has lost a job, lost a home, lost their health, lost the American dream. Many critics of the movement complain that the movement has no message, that it is confused, disorganized, unfocused. I say that they perceive brilliantly that it manifests in a concentrated form what is happening in the United States at large. What they see as confusion and disorganization demonstrates just how deep and complex the problems are. It also demonstrates that these problems cannot be solved by the people in the park. They cannot be solved by the citizens alone. But they can be solved. Just as the Wall Street occupiers solved the problem of being without loudspeakers by using human chanters to amplify their speakers' voices, there are ingenious ways to solve our financial crisis just waiting to be discovered. This will take time, it will take dedication, but it will come. It won't come, though, without everyone who participates in our system coming to the table. The citizens of Wall Street and the policymakers who do their bidding bear responsibility for making the necessary changes that will resolve the crisis that has brought the Wall Street occupiers to their backyard. These citizens who have lost their own backyards now are camped out in Wall Street's backyard, and they won't leave until Wall Street citizens come out and sit down with them to fix our broken system. We all know for certain that we cannot continue life as though nothing is happening. That is like the captain of the Titanic who ordered the orchestra to keep playing as the ship sank. It didn't stop the ship from sinking, did it? So I invite you to leave your televisions, leave your video games, leave your barbecues and birthday parties. The band might keep playing, but the ship is still sinking. And we need to get to bailing out the ship. We cannot go on partying like it's 1999. 1999 has been and gone, my friends, and it is now 2011 and nearly 2012, and it is time for change. Change means that each and every one of you must decide that the house is burning, the boat is sinking, the river is rising, whatever disaster metaphor does it for you, now is the time to heed that call. There is no turning back from this. No one is coming to rescue us. There is no bailout for the American people, but the bailout we provide ourselves. It is time to get to work, my friends, and it is time to get to work now. Part of that getting to work is educating yourself, and that is what we aim to do, and that's how we aim to help you with this show, and that's why I've invited today's guest, Sean Hyde, to educate us about what's happening and what we can do to thrive even in the midst of the turmoil around us. So I'm going to welcome Sean back to the show, and I thank you for indulging me for a moment. I needed to say all of that because it really is important. For those of us who are able to get down to Zuccotti Park and experience it, I think we're all this inspired to speak to what's going on over there. And I invite everybody to come and participate because this is an issue that is important to us all. So, Sean, your microphone is back on. Thank you for being here and welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Great. Well, we were talking just before we went to a break about the reality of the situation. We are dealing with currencies that are no longer backed by anything but ideas. People agreeing together that the dollar has a certain value and the Deutschmark has a certain value or the euro has a certain value. And when there's uncertainty about that, things can get really hectic and complicated, and we can have some of the results that we're seeing in the market today. And so what I'd like us to focus on now is what the ordinary person can do. As you pointed out in the first half of the show, most of us have most of our savings in 401ks that are then managed by mutual funds, and apparently that means that we can be really vulnerable to what's going on in the stock market. So what is the average person to do?
I think the most important thing the average person has to realize is that they need to educate themselves. You know, we have an education system that is not set up to teach anyone anything about finance. We expect everyone to go through several years of biology and English and math and chemistry, and not to say that those aren't important, but for a society that operates around money and there's, a lot of financial constraints, we don't teach anyone basic finance. A lot of people don't even realize, for a good example right now, if your money is in a savings account, you're maybe earning 1% interest, while the real inflation rate's 3.5%. So a savings account is actually losing you 2.5% a year right now. That doesn't save anything, at that point. And, you know, these are basic concepts that a lot of people aren't even aware of. As I said, you know, with your 401ks and your IRAs, people don't even understand what they actually are or, you know, why they're in them, you know, the tax-deferred status, or if it's a Roth IRA, the tax-free status, or, you know, the different reasons to do that. Those are really important things to know, and no one's ever going to care more about your money than you do, so you have to learn those.
But let me ask you a question here and back up for a moment, because this point that you're making about savings accounts I think is really important. If you don't mind bookmarking where you were going and focusing on this for just a second, because one of the things that I thought when, you know, I'm thinking about the stock market is plunging and the money in the 401ks is disappearing is, why don't I just take it all out and put it in the mattress under my bed?
Well, and there are people that are going to tell you that's the safest thing to do. And the truth is, if the stock market's going to lose 50% and your cash is going to lose 2 or 3%, are you still better off that way? Yes. But if you take a little time to educate yourself that, you know, during the time the market's been so weak, things like gold and silver are up 500%, 600%, 700% in that same time period, you know, other commodities, oils and food, you know, as far as like corn and wheat and some of those things have had the same kind of run-ups. There's always something out there that people are putting their money into, and as long as you pay attention to what that is, you can always make money off piggybacking off of them.
You've made a really important point here for a moment. Let's put this in practical terms. I'm thinking that if I were you know, a person who was more savvy and had more of a handle of where my money is, I perhaps would have diversified and had some money in stocks and in bonds and some money in gold and silver and, you know, other precious metals and so forth. And so at this point in the market, the strategy I might have taken, and, you know, correct me if I'm wrong about this, but the strategy I might have taken is to, at this point, sell gold because it is at record highs, and use that to replace the losses that I was experiencing in the stock market. Is that, practically speaking, what somebody might want to do?
No, if not in my opinion, at least. Obviously, everyone's going to have a different opinion. Gold and silver are fear hedges. So when there's uncertainty in the market, that's where people tend to put their money because, as we talked about, currencies tend to fluctuate based on what everybody thinks, basically, of that country at that time, where gold and silver have been around a really long time, and they're really considered the true money throughout history. And the truth is, gold isn't necessarily at record highs. I believe in the late 70s, early 80s, it was around 1800, which we've passed at this point. But
okay,
as we know, $1,800 30 years ago is not $1,800 today.
Right.
There are a lot of things 30 years ago you could buy for $1,800 that are going to cost you $10,000 or $20,000 now. So from a real perspective, we're not at record highs. Are we, you know, 600% higher than we were a decade ago? Absolutely. But does that mean it's the end of it? No. I mean, the stock market, when it went up hundreds of percent, people didn't sit there and say, oh, no, you know, there's no reason to stay in it anymore. And they kept going, and eventually it did pull back, and eventually gold and silver, and those will pull back as well when the fear recedes from the overall market. But the truth is, selling your winning investments to cover your losing investments is kind of like beginner investing mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, your average beginner investor, what they do is they hold their losers too long and they sell their winners too quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very normal. So, yes, a lot of people will say, oh, I've doubled my money in gold, let me sell. But the truth is, there's no indication that that run is over yet. Where the stock market, there are plenty of indications that there could be a lot of problems in the stock market to come. So it's normal, and that's what the average person would do, but that's also why the average person ends up broke.
Ah, right. So let's move beyond being the average person. What strategy or set of strategies, perhaps, would you suggest that a person start looking into?
I think basically, as I said, education, we're in the information age for a reason. People are making billion-dollar companies out of the garage for a reason, because right now ideas run the world. You know, we're not the manufacturing age. It doesn't matter who can make steel. It doesn't matter who can make the best car anymore. It matters who has the best information and who can get it to you the fastest.
Okay.
In that same way, it's who has the information. So if you can sit there and say, yes, I think there's reason to believe something could go wrong. I'm not saying put all your money into gold and silver, but if you say, hey, 10% of the money I would have put into the stock market, I start putting it into gold or silver, and maybe 10% I put into things that make money when the stock market goes down. You know, there are hedging opportunities. There are put options. There are things that will make you money when that stock market goes down. There are even funds, what are called contrarian funds, that are mutual funds set up just to make money when the stock market goes down.
So talk to me about what hedging is.
Hedging in general is basically just a term for covering your bases. It means if you were in the stock market and the only way you're positioned is like a normal person where you've bought shares, so the only way there you would make money is off the stock going up or maybe dividends. Hedging is putting in using options or selling strategies that can actually make you some money on the way down as well to cover your losses or to actually make you money. I believe the last time we talked about the put option trade I did in July.
Yes.
Where I bought options that are called put options, and a put option is one that actually makes money when the stock goes down instead of up, where I purchased put options for $900 that I sold for $8,000 2.5 weeks later because the price of Google pulled back so far. You know, so that's basically your basic example of hedging, is to say, okay, I have a lot of money in a mutual fund, so maybe it's tech heavy. Well, I also want to put something into where I can make money if the techs bomb.
Okay. And so basically, would I be incorrect to say that it was a bet, that you made a bet that at a certain point the stock is going to fall?
I don't consider trading a bet. I've been doing it for a long time. And I use what's called technical analysis, which means I strictly look at price movements. I don't look at the news. I don't listen to what people say about companies. Quite honestly, people laugh at me, but I don't even know what the company does that I buy a lot of times because I don't care.
Mm.
You can look at basic price movements and tell what people are feeling at that time. You know, there are patterns that become obvious when you learn basic price manipulation that you can say, okay, right now there are a lot more buyers than sellers, and that stock's going to keep going up, or vice versa. But the best way to do that is to just look at the numbers. When you start listening to people on the news, when you start looking even at the financials, like there's so many accounting firms, we've watched them go down for lying about earnings and price earnings ratios and book values and faking numbers. And, you know, look at Enron and look at Lucent Technologies, where they fudge numbers to make themselves look good, and then the stock got destroyed and people lost a lot of money. You can't rely on that anymore. You know, 20 years ago, you could listen to the news, you could get an accounting degree and look at the books and say, oh, this is a strong company. But it's too easy to manipulate that now. And really, the best way to do it is to look at the way the stock price is actually moving. So in my mind, because of that, there are certain levels that people tend to buy at and tend to sell at. So once you get to know a stock or two or three, you can look and say, wow, every time the stock hits 500, it seems to sell off and it can't get past 500. So in that example, if it got to 500, I would buy the put option and try to make the money off the people selling it that are not willing to buy at a higher price than 500.
Ah, so it's a matter of basically experience and understanding what is working, where and when. Right, so that leads me then to ask, you know, folks have jobs, you know, they have 9-to-5 jobs. How is one to put in the time? It sounds like it's really time consuming to do what you're doing.
Honestly, it's not. There is time to learn in the beginning, but the truth is, if you're not willing to put the time in to read a few books and maybe take 6 months, you can do what's called paper trading, which is like a practice trading account where it's fake money and it's not yours, and you can learn when to get in and when to get out and to keep an eye on things. If your life savings is not worth taking the time to learn that, then that's why you're going to end up like the average person.
Okay.
After that point, it's not. I literally have put in 3 trades this year. I maybe spend a half an hour a week looking at charts, and that's how I get in and out. I trade on a longer-term basis. You know, I buy things that, you know, 2.5 weeks doesn't sound like a long-term basis, but right now it is. When the market's swinging 500 points a day, 2 weeks you can see a big move, you know? So, but I think that's the main thing, is just understanding that you can do anything you want to these days to make money, and it doesn't even matter what you're in, it matters how you're in it.
Right, okay. So are there any particular resources that you found to be especially helpful that you can recommend?
I think you really can start off however you want. I actually like the old Robert Kiyosaki books, The Rich Dad, Poor Dad, Basic Beginning. I think before he got so infomercially like he is now, he had some really good ideas on not only investing, but, you know, starting businesses and taxes, which are a big thing people don't think about all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But they do. I mean, the average person loses 30 to 40% of their income off taxes. So that's something you should know about. I think that's really good. And there are a lot of, you know, even free resources on the internet right now. There's a company called Trade the Markets, where there's about 5 professional traders that put out a free 3-minute video every night that you can sign up for, it and they send it to you. And every day you can spend 10 minutes learning how to become a better trader and a better investor. And they talk about, you know, everything from the overall world economy to individual stock trades or option trades or futures trades. You know, there are a lot of things like that out there now, libraries of books. But the main thing is to get started, you know, find what you're interested in, learn about it. You know, a lot of people talk about diversification, but Warren Buffett, who's probably considered the best investor of our time, says put all your eggs in one basket and just watch that basket really carefully. And that's kind of true. You know, obviously he's been very successful with that. And what he's saying is, you know, find one thing that you want to know and just get really, really good at it. And I think investing is no different. You don't necessarily have to know everything in the world. You have to know one thing well enough that you are better at it than someone else so you can make a little money.
Right. Well, you know, as you've been speaking and giving this really important and helpful advice, it's come to me that really we have to change our behavior as people who are involved in our own finances, in terms of how we're involved in our own finances. You mentioned earlier on in the show that it used to be that people's savings were in pension plans and that the pension plans were guaranteed and basically they were run by the companies that folks worked for. And when the shift happened where it was no longer pension plans but 401k plans, that responsibility and the risk was shifted to the employees. What seems to not have happened is for the employees' behavior to also shift. And so we've been behaving as though our 401k plans still are pension plans. And the truth is that our behavior has to change because that risk shifting demands that.
Correct. Well, I think, you know, no one ever told people that they had to learn about this. So I think a lot of people kind of went along and didn't think that they had to learn about this. Like I said, the school systems don't teach you that. Even, you know, when you get into college and upper level education, they don't teach you that. And things people have to be aware of is a government is very strongly influenced by business. You know, your top education facilities, your top business schools are all sponsored by businesses. Businesses need employees. They need people that need to work for them their whole life for a paycheck, that need to be dependent on that income. They don't want people that are financially independent and can do whatever they want and go off and do their own thing. So there's no, you know, motivation for them to teach you how to be a good investor, how to be financially independent, how to be self-sufficient. So they don't. You know, and I don't think they ever will because it doesn't help them any. You know, the people that support the most of the government and the taxes and these school systems, you know, they need people to work for them, not against them, or not need to work for anybody. So people have to take responsibility for their own financial education.
Well, and I think that that is really the takeaway from this show is that you don't have a choice. You can't keep your head in the sand about what's going on with your money. You have to educate yourself and take a more active role in what happens with your money.
Absolutely. And, you know, like I touched on before, no one's ever going to care about your money like you do. And the truth is our system's not set up for them too. Brokers don't make money by making your money. They make money off transactions. Mutual funds do make money off having more assets under their control, but they can do that just as easily by getting new people as they can by actually making more money within the fund. So, you know, it's not always in their best interest to keep making you money. You're really the only person out there that has a real keen interest in increasing your net worth, your income, and your money. So you have to use that motivation, you know. If that's important to you, then a little less time sleeping or eating or, you know, watching TV or whatever it is you want to do, even if it's an hour a week or an hour a month, can make a huge difference in the long run, just understanding how it works around you so you can decide your financial fate rather than letting all these other people do it for you.
Well, here's something that I've decided that I'm going to do as a practical step. You mentioned paper trading, and I thought, okay, fine. You know, I've read some financial books myself. I'll pick up Kiyosaki's book. But I'm interested in practicing first. I don't feel confident just jumping out there and, you know, having somebody make trades for me and deciding how that's going to work. So where would I go to start practicing, for example?
Pretty much any online broker or any online financial news source has a paper trading setup now. I personally like to use Options Express, I find, you know, for my trading, and they have a paper trading account. But I'm pretty sure even like Yahoo Business or any, if you do a search for stock quotes, I think almost any of those sites will allow you to open paper trading or practice trading accounts. And you could even do just a search for paper trading, and I'm sure they will come up, but I don't know many specifically besides that.
Okay.
Because I've been doing this a little bit longer at this point.
Sure.
But I think that's important to do in conjunction with learning a little bit. You know, you don't want to just do paper trades randomly or, and go out there because sometimes you're going to be successful, you know, on luck. you know, I've known people that have opened a paper trading account just at the right time. The market shot up, they've made a lot of money and said, oh, well, obviously I'm ready to go trade. And that's a mistake. You want to use that to learn, to say, why was I successful? You know, what's going to make me continue to be successful? And, you know, what strategies do I want to learn and implement?
So then when you've reached a point where you feel a little bit more confident, you want to actually do it, you know, what practically do I do to reach out to the person who has control of my money? I don't even know where it is, right? So who has control of my money so that I can start actually doing something?
The first thing is obviously to find out where it is. I meet a lot of people that are say things along the lines of, I have a 401k from three jobs ago. I don't know what it's in or how to get at it. You know, obviously you want to have that money. You want to find out if your 401k lets you self-direct your money. That's what it's called when you pick the stocks and the trades. And if not, you want to consider moving it out of that 401k into, say, a Roth IRA or into something where you can control the money. Because depending on your company, a lot of companies have a 401k with an option of eight different funds you can go into, but all eight funds are bullish stock funds. Mm-hmm. You know, so even though they're a little different, they're still going to crush you when the market goes down and only going to make you money when the market goes up. If they're not giving you bear market options, if they're not giving you precious metals options, if they're not giving you safe haven income options, then you need to really consider moving it to somewhere where you can get at those options.
Okay. So basically, you know, contact the folks in HR who work with your 401k fund folks, and they can tell you what you need to do and who you need to contact in order to get started.
Correct. They're always going to have your 401k set up through a financial company. Usually it's a company that has a lot of their own mutual funds because that's how they work out the deal. You know, say Fidelity or, you know, one of those companies that has their own fund family already. They're just going to tell you to contact them, and then you're going to call up the Fidelity person and say, hi, I want to know if I can start self-directing my 401k. And they're either going to say yes and here's how to do it, or they're going to say no, that's not one of the options within your company. And if that's the case, you're going to want to talk to a different company and find out about rolling it over.
Ah, okay. So I think the takeaway for the show again is that even if the stock market is going up, if it's going down, if you educate yourself, you will find out how it is that you can make money even when the stock market goes down. If you've educated yourself, there are tools that you can use in order to self-direct your funds, and it's just a matter of getting out there using the internet. It is the information age. The information is all there and available to you. It's just up to you to get up and get moving, right?
Absolutely. The most important thing is to know that the information is there, and if you care enough, you can control your money and you can find out how to control your money in a way that's going to save it when the world's potentially falling apart.
Right. Wow. Thank you so much, Sean, for coming on the show and for providing this fantastic information. I know that I have my marching orders, and really, as soon as the show's over, I'm getting online and finding out what I can. So I really, really appreciate what you've done and what you've given us in terms of information.
I'm glad to help.
Wonderful. Well, thank you all for listening as well. I hope that you have benefited from listening today. The main point is that none of us can afford to do nothing. We can survive and thrive even in the midst of this crisis. We can see it as something that's not a crisis if we are informed. Information is powerful and very valuable. We'll have to work at it, but somewhere, somehow, there is an answer for all of us, and that's the song I'm going to leave you with this week. This is Vijay Iyer. The album is called Historicity, and the piece is called Somewhere from West Side Story. Tune in next week for more as we examine the problem to find the answer. Have a wonderful week, everyone.